Welcome to Risk and Business, the Advent Iron podcast. Today, Mike Gillespie is going to be talking to Phil Ingram. It's against the backdrop of the Salisbury poisonings drama to look at some of the human aspects that it highlighted and also to expand that out into the ramping up of nation-state activity, including cyber attacks. We're going to look at propaganda and counter-propaganda, misinformation, and potentially touching on some interesting subjects around the propagation of fake news and the use of social media. So an awful lot of stuff to cover. Over to Mike and Phil.
Phil, good morning and welcome. It's great to see you, actually, albeit virtually. And great to have an opportunity for us to talk and have a good catch-up.
Good morning, Mike. It's fantastic to be able to talk again. Yes, strange times, aren't they?
I find myself almost at times surreal, you know, surreal times. And particularly for me, because I live up in the Pennines, which is very rural, is at times it's all felt strangely normal.
Yeah.
And then at other times you suddenly realise actually normality has completely gone out the window. So, yeah.
Yes, and normality has changed. And when we come out of it, I think whatever the new normal will be, and I don't know whether I quite like that phrase, but it's going to be not quite the same as it was before we went into lockdown.
No, and I think, you know, well, we'll maybe talk about some of these things, but some of it for the best and maybe some of it not for the best. But I think there are changes afoot that will certainly change the way that we interact societally and from businesses as well. So, you know, lots of change coming. But I found myself, and one of the reasons that we reached out to you, I found myself watching the Salisbury poisoning drama recently.
Yeah.
And, well, there were a couple of things that struck me. One is, good grief, it was only just over 2 years ago.
I know. Where's that 2 years gone?
It seems so long ago because so many other things have happened, including the B word. Multiple elections, you know, we've exited the union and we've had a pandemic, and you sort of think surely all of that hasn't happened in just 2 years, but it has. So how strange a world we've lived in.
It is. Well, and the frightening thing is, you know, the word unprecedented, which we keep hearing at the moment, and we heard in, you know, each of the number 10 Downing Street press briefings through lockdown until they've stopped. It was, I think, first used, or the first time I can remember it, is during the Skripal poisoning, the Salisbury poisonings, as the BBC have brought a new series out on.
So I was thinking, you know, I was watching the, and obviously what the BBC have produced is a docudrama. So, you know, largely factual, but having to fill in the gaps in terms of certain dialogue or taking some artistic license in order to keep the flow going and to keep the timelines and things like that. But for me, broadly speaking, as somebody who was very much watching from the periphery anyway and never actively involved, it seemed like an incredibly intense, scary, I think there was a lot that, in hindsight, I was looking at the press reportage of it that never really came through, which was that actually this affected the lives of lots of people.
Yeah.
It wasn't simply a nation state attack on one defector. Actually, there was a whole community involved in this.
Oh, a massive community effort in there. It affected the whole of Salisbury and the surround. And I think in a way it's affected the country. Not necessarily outside Salisbury at an individual level, but right up at a political level, both our relationships there have been subsequently with Russia, but also some of the relationships that there have been with our other partners around the place. You know, I was heavily involved at all through the crisis as a the Salisbury crisis as a commentator, because A, with my military intelligence background, you know, I was a direct equivalent to Sergei Skripal. B, whenever I commanded my battalion, I had specialist surveillance capabilities that were trained to follow and surveil trained Russian military intelligence capabilities, and we did on occasions. So I understood that. And also for my sins, I had, in my first degree and second degree at the Royal Military College of Science, studied the effects of chemical weapons in quite a lot of detail. So I knew the chemistry and the biology of how it affected people. So I was called as a commentator, and on the BBC series was quite surprised when I saw my ugly mug pop up on the screen as part of the opening sequence as one of the commentators.
I was just about to bring that up, Mr. Ingram, actually. Your now infamous cameo.
Yes. I was sitting there listening to it and thought, I recognise that voice. I wonder who that is. And then this face came up and went, oh, crikey, it's me. How did I get on there? So it was interesting. I think the programme itself is well put together. It focuses on the people side of it, and I think that's really important. But also I think they had to, because we have to remember that this is still an active murder investigation that's going on. Counterterrorism Police UK have got an active file going. Enough information has been released to get the Crown Prosecution Service to issue an arrest warrant against Colonels Mishkin and Chepiga from the Russian GRU, or their first directorate, their military intelligence organization. And that's resulted in an Interpol red notice being issued, so that there's a requirement for them to be extradited to the UK to face charges. But they don't need to release anything else whilst they continue.
Obviously, having done 14 days of quarantine first.
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah. But unfortunately, we'll never see them, because the Russian constitution does not allow Russian citizens to be extradited for any reason whatsoever. And interestingly, if we go back a few years to the Litvinenko poisoning with polonium 210, the radioactive substance, the individual that was accused of doing that, again, hasn't been out of Russia, but he's then gone into politics and is now part of the Duma, so part of the Russian political system that's there as their decision makers. So it's scary. But the series humanizes a lot of what went on. And I think that in one way was really important, because it put a personality behind Dawn Sturgis, the poor lady who died because of her spraying Novichok on her wrists from the bottle that her boyfriend Charlie Rowley had found. It put the human side of Detective Sergeant Nick Bailey and the impact that it had on him personally, but on his family as well. And you know, you said it's only 2 years ago. That impact is still being felt today. So maybe this series was a little early, but then when's the right time is always the question. And I think the third thing that it brought out, which was quite interesting, was the role that Tracy Draskovich had as Wiltshire's Director of Public Health, and the way she had to bring together a huge multi-agency response to this unprecedented event, and how they had to get together to try and look at the impact that it was going to have in the community and balance that impact on the community against keeping real life going at the same time. Were we getting that dilemma at the moment in a much larger scale with the COVID-19 pandemic? And there's some interesting lessons to come out of that. Because I understand it from an intelligence perspective, a surveillance perspective, an espionage perspective, a chemical weapons perspective, I was slightly frustrated that some of the questions that are still out there that are hanging in the air didn't get answered. But I understand completely why. It wouldn't have fitted or added to the drama. And it didn't stop my enjoyment of the drama in any way, shape or form. So it's a good one.
So you mentioned that, you know, obviously one of the fallouts of this has been, or was at the time and continues to be, a change in relationships with certain nation states. And of course, you've just mentioned COVID as well, which in turn has brought the spotlight back on certain nation states. And by certain nation states, of course, I'm thinking about the big two here, Russia and China.
Yep.
Certainly, you know, the Americans are going all out to blame China for the current pandemic.
Yeah.
But, you know, Russia has for a long time been quite buoyant in saying we can do whatever we want and nobody can stop us and Russia. And I think, you know, we saw that, as you said there, you know, off the back of the polonium, off the back of the Novichok, and even now with Russia just sort of saying, hey, we're Russia, even this virus can't touch us because Russia, we're the bear.
Yep. Well, again, this is something that came to the fore in the follow on from the Skripal affair in Salisbury. If we put it into context, you know, a lot of people believe that the primary reason for the attack on Sergei Skripal was because he was a defector, because he was a traitor to Russia, and Vladimir Putin wanted him dead. There's no doubt that Vladimir Putin wanted him dead and all the rest of it. But you have to ask, why then? He'd have other opportunities to do this. Why use Novichok? There's so many other whys that come out of it. And when you start to analyze that and you look at it, you look at the time frame that's in there and you look at the location, and those are critical. The time frame, it was exactly 14 days before the Russian presidential election. Vladimir Putin had got rid of the opposition by putting the leader of the opposition into prison. However, he had a couple of oligarchs that lived overseas that were threatening to cause real difficulties in the election because they were anti-Putin. He wanted to send them a very clear message. And that very clear message was, don't mess with me because I can get you anywhere at any time in a very nasty way. The vehicle that he used to send that message was trying to assassinate Sergei Skripal, a legitimate target in his eyes. But the reason why Sergei Skripal was chosen, and this ties in with your point on disinformation, was because he lived in Salisbury. And Salisbury, just outside Salisbury, a couple of miles outside Salisbury, is the UK's chemical weapons research establishment at Porton Down. The message was sent quite clearly, and Novichok was used because that could be linked to Russia very quickly, and it would leak out into the press, and that would send the message to the oligarchs and all the rest of it that this was Russian that did it. But because nobody knew about it, it brought in a degree of plausible deniability for Putin. And the second element of plausible deniability was he could turn around and say, oh no, this has nothing to do with us. It escaped from the British research establishment of Porton Down. It was them what done it, gov. And surprise, surprise, one of the first statements he came out with was that.
Sowing seeds of doubt and alternative.
Correct. And, the Russians have got a doctrine for that, and it's called maskarovka, or masking. And it's something that they've done the whole way through USSR days and now into Russia days. And it's part of every bit of activity that they've got, which is producing disinformation, false information, trying to manipulate the way people think by putting messaging out in a very carefully targeted way. And there's two audiences. There's their external audience and there's their internal audience. So whenever Russia then got accused and Theresa May, the then prime minister, stood up in parliament and said it was Russia, this was only 5 days before the Russian general election. We've got a country where the economy was tanking, unemployment's going through the roof, cost of living's going through the roof. Any normal government in any normal democracy would be voted out. Putin got a bigger percentage of the vote than he had in his previous election because he could sit in the back of his horse with his shirt off and say, we're being accused of this heinous crime. I'm the strong leader to stop the West from accusing us of things that we would never do. And he pleaded to nationalism, which is a very big driver amongst Russian culture. And that's what got him an extra percentage of the vote, assuming every vote was legitimate, of course.
Of course. But, you know, you mentioned there sort of, you know, misinformation and propaganda. I mean, but isn't that true of every nation state? And hasn't it been true as far back as the idea of information, misinformation, counter misinformation and propaganda has existed?
It's nothing new. If you want to go right back in history, the first time I've read of misinformation, disinformation and deception as being a legitimate tactic, and it's been put in writing, is back in the 6th century, where if you go to Sun Tzu's Art of War, Sun Tzu turns around and says that all warfare is deception, all deception is warfare. Now, deception and misinformation, disinformation and fake news, it's all the same. If we project forward to the Second World War, leaving out a lot of history in between, it's always been part of military and therefore nation state tactics. But in the Second World War, we were masters of it. We convinced Hitler that we were going to go into the Pas de Calais instead of through Normandy. Yeah. In doing that, we dropped dead bodies with false top secret plans out of aircraft in the Mediterranean and knowing that they'd be washed up and the German intelligence services would take them. We set up a complete false army with a real commander, with real signals coming out of it, with real messages, with real press coverage of what was going on, with real slash blow up vehicles, but it looked real to aircraft that were coming over from a reconnaissance perspective, to deceive the enemy into what was going on. And that's why the Normandy landings were so successful, because Hitler was convinced that the real landings were still going to come in from Pas-de-Calais. But since then, we have lost the art of that, whereas a lot of other nations have continued to exploit it. And a lot of those nations have been followed the old Soviet bloc training, have been trained by the Russians, have worked their way through. And I remember in the Balkans, in the Kosovo conflict, the Serbs were masters at deception when it came to trying to show that they had armored vehicles in certain places, that they had activity going on in certain places. And we bombed more empty fields, more buildings that we thought there were air defense radars in, because they'd taken a microwave oven, ripped the door off, pressed the micro switch in, or glued the micro switch in, switched it on, which gave out a frequency very similar to an anti-aircraft radar, and our anti-radiation missiles then flew in and blew the microwaves up. They put burning oil drums on bridges to make it look as if those bridges had been attacked. The deception was there then, and it's continued. Saddam Hussein's deception led to a little bit too far, bluffing us into believing that he was a real threat, and the invasion of Iraq.
Just went a little bit too far there, Phil, you think?
He did, and it's interesting if you go back and analyze it. He was doing it deliberately. He just got it wrong. He knew that we were listening into the UN inspectors, the chemical weapons inspection, into the military communications that was going on around the place. And when the inspectors, there was one incident I remember, when the inspectors left a particular site, the commander of the site got onto the communications to Baghdad and said, these idiots couldn't find a needle in a haystack if we'd shown them exactly where it was, and highlighted it in bright red. As they were leaving, there was no reason for him to say that if there's nothing there. He deliberately built in one of his test facilities a test Ventura for a rocket that, when you take the imagery of it, it's straight mathematics as to, you see the Ventura, how big a rocket is that to test? And that it's a straight mathematical calculation to work that out. The Ventura was bigger than any of the rockets that were allowed under the current United Nations restrictions that had been placed on Iraq at the time. And therefore, the assumption was made, and here's where assumptions are always difficult, that if he's got a test facility for it, he must have the rockets or be developing the rockets for it. But he wasn't. He just built the test facility because he knew that our imagery systems could see it.
And there you go. You see, if you poke the sleeping bear too many times, actually, it puts me in mind of the Japanese high command after Pearl Harbor, the statement that I read once, which is, we have awoken a sleeping giant. And, it's, of course, history is littered with these sort of...
Well, exactly. And we've got two giants that have been... To say they're sleeping is wrong, but they have been pushed onto the back burner from our perspective. And you mentioned them earlier. It's Russia and China. And those two giants are slowly but surely churning away in the background, achieving a lot of things that they want to achieve. And we're missing out on it.
I remember when I was serving in the military and they started to downsize and refocus because... the Cold War was over. Russia was no longer going to be a threat. We had a new way of working with Russia. All of our focus would be on quick reaction forces. And of course, what's happening in the background is Russia are very much rebuilding, recapitalizing on the breakdown of the Soviet Union, consolidating and building up both their propaganda arm and their military arm to make sure that they continue to be a threat.
Yep.
And of course, as we've seen with the statement from Dominic Raab in the last couple of weeks, you know, he's very clearly come out and said he believes that both Russia and China have very actively and deliberately capitalized on COVID-19 in order to progress their own political ends. And that includes the use of cyberspace, and that includes the use of social media and other media outlets for propaganda and misinformation.
Oh, 100%. And you people think, well, it's just information. Well, how is that going to affect us? What's going to happen here? Where is it going on? How is it going to affect my economy? And we'll go back to Salisbury again. The day that France, Germany, the United States put out a public condemnation of Russia and named Russia as the perpetrator of the attack in Salisbury, the German government and Angela Merkel personally went and signed a multi-billion euro deal with Gazprom, the Russian national gas provider, to provide gas into Germany. So on the one hand, they were publicly condemning Russia. On the other hand, they were signing a multi-billion euro deal to take Russian products and put profit back into the Russian government. There's a bit of duplicity that's in there. And that continues the whole way through. And it's interesting. Russia and China are in a very fortunate position. China has a leader with Xi Jinping who is in for life. He can lead the country for as long as he wants. Vladimir Putin is jealous of that. He's got a few constitutional hurdles to get over, but has set the conditions for him to be president, president, prime minister, president, president, and is now setting the conditions where he can be, again, president for life, like Xi Jinping. What advantage does that give them? That means that they're not having to plan things in prime ministerial or presidential election timeframes in a democratic society. Not that either of those societies are democratic, but it means that their decision making, their strategic planning can be over a number of years and generations rather than having to be in a probably a 3-year rather than 5-year timeframe to achieve anything. So as we're whizzing around trying to do something to achieve something today because it gets the sensational headlines, they're planning something long term and can say, right, if we influence these headlines that are being whizzed around at the moment in the Western countries, even in a slight way, we can influence the way people are thinking, and we can influence that to our advantage to allow us to sign more Gazprom type deals, to influence the rollout of 5G networks and our technologies that are coming in there, to take greater influence into South China Seas and what's happening in Southeast Asia through a very slow but deliberate strategic growth of ownership of land or land grab that China's doing in those sorts of areas, whilst Russia is being a little less subtle in its land grab that we've seen in Ukraine, Crimea, which is part of Ukraine, the influence that they've got in Syria with Bashar al-Assad and elsewhere. So it's fascinating to see the two different systems working completely differently. And I think we in the West, because we're whizzing around so fast, have taken our eye off the ball of the great Russian bear and the great China, greater China that's there. And we're doing that at our peril, and they are winning.
So, you know, we've kind of almost been too focused on the front that is the Middle East, haven't we? And all the stuff that's been going on there. And of course, these two traditional giants have really capitalized on that.
Yeah.
But one of the things that they're both incredibly good at capitalizing on is the growth in media, social media,
yep,
the contact points with the general population, whereas before that would have to have been reported by for us to have consumed it, it's now everywhere.
Yep. Yeah.
But what I've seen from that has been, you know, a lot of dangerous behaviors as well, you know, where we've seen, you know, people dying because they've taken bleach because of misinformation or, you know, I mean, potentially the emergency services capability to respond to people dying from COVID put at risk because of people burning 5G masts.
Yes.
Because the message was that 5G spread the virus. So, you know, some of this propaganda and misinformation has state to state implications, but a huge amount of it actually, much as we were saying with Salisbury, also has societal implications that affect real people.
Yeah. Well, again, this is even more interesting, and it's the reason why I think the propaganda, the misinformation, the manipulation of the perception of truth by one side, which we were so good at the Second World War. The difference between the Second World War is decisions were made centrally at central government. You got a whole society approach, and central government controlled the messaging output and where that went to. We're now in an era of social media. everyone has got access to everything at all times. That means that everyone can have an opinion at all times, but everyone's opinion can be informed. And therefore, if you get a country or an organization that's got the ability to look at things from a holistic perspective and how to manipulate thinking in that, there is and then to tweak their messaging in a slight way to try and affect the way people are thinking, then again, those countries are doing that, and China and Russia are masters at it. Perfect example goes back to Salisbury again. Whenever President Putin came out with his statement to say it must have escaped from Porton Down, this wasn't us, it could have been criminals that brought it in, it definitely wasn't us, he was probably sitting back behind his desk in the Kremlin with a very large glass of vodka over ice, stroking a white cat on his lap when he saw the leader of the opposition party stand up in Parliament and start to question every bit of decision-making that the government had done because he believed that there was this disinformation piece that he'd seen in there and believed that we should explore the doubt. Well, Putin had achieved his aim. You know, he'd got the argument going on inside our own political structures and it became self-perpetuating then for a while. And our press picks up on sensationalism. So as soon as that happens, the press, instead of going, right, let's look at this from a neutral perspective and question everything properly, we're going to look at this and go, oh, there's sensationalism. There's difference between that side and that side. And therefore, let's exploit that difference because it sells more newspapers.
And isn't part of that actually is the role that mainstream journalism has now taken? I found myself thinking this through this pandemic when I've watched things like, you know, the press conferences with the PM and his various aides, and the reportage and the way that they're not reporting facts anymore, they're reporting opinions.
Yep.
And actually, in many ways, what they're seeking to do is create public opinion that is common to their opinion rather than just reporting the facts.
Yep.
You know, I find myself watching some of the questions after the PM's briefing as we went into lockdown. And the reporters, to me, they were asking just absolutely banal questions. But what they wanted to do was then be able to create a headline that says, and the PM doesn't have an answer for this. Oh, the government is completely clueless. Yeah. Oh, we should all reject lockdown. You know, these sort of things were coming out almost as soon as we went into lockdown.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And I think the real danger that's come out of this, and this is something we're suffering at the moment, is that the press have been going after the sensationalist headline. And therefore, what they're not doing is they're not questioning things from a neutral perspective to try and get a balanced opinion and to report that opinion. They're trying to find fault, they're trying to find blame. And in their desire to do that, what they're doing is when they're reporting things from a sensationalist and therefore very often a one-sided perspective. They're not giving the whole picture. What that does is it then, instead of informing the public as to what's going on, what they're doing is, I think they're informing public opinion, because the press is saying that everyone's angry because this is wrong, and therefore everyone's saying, oh, I should be angry because the government didn't do this. And the reality is most people probably hadn't realised or weren't interested. But when their favourite newspaper or their favourite commentator says, this must be your opinion, they go, that must be my opinion. And then that feeds back into our political system, and we've got an adversarial political system. And because it's an adversarial political system, instead of the opposition parties turning around and going, let's look at the arguments from a logical perspective, which some MPs, opposition MPs do, and they're very good at it, but a large number are driven by a populist approach, and that populist approach is informed by what they're seeing in the papers, and what they're seeing in the papers as public opinion is, and therefore it's being informed by the unbalanced reporting that's coming out from a lot of the mainstream commentators, and therefore it leads to unbalanced questioning in Parliament and increases the confrontation. And the worst case of that confrontation is your society sees a confrontation going on in Parliament. It loses confidence in government. So when we get instances like the Black Lives Matter that's going on at the moment, and the demonstrations that are going around that, and so they're very legitimate demonstrations, those elements that want to cause harm and to fight against society. And if you drill into the back of those, some of those are funded or have propaganda directed at them by nation states that are out there. They cause the destruction and the damage to property, and in some cases the potential for loss of life that we've seen. And that's really, really bad.
And the potential to create yet another public health issue, which is, you know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, you know, still detecting at the time over 1,000 new cases a day. So this is not like we were suddenly virus free again. And when you bring thousands and thousands of people together, as we've seen in certain factory environments now, where you just bring a couple of hundred people together, the R rate can spike incredibly quickly with this voracious and very infectious disease. So, you know, it's creating a whole load of public health issues, which, you know, if I was a cynic, which I'm not, because I leave that to you, I would say that nation states who don't fully agree with our ideals might want to create a public health issue, because that way we overwhelm our public services, we create public unrest, we create uncertainty, we create distrust in the government and its policies. It undermines the whole of democratic society.
Well, and there's wider implications in that. It affects the economy, so it's going to take us longer to recover, and therefore we're going to have greater difficulty competing with China as it breaks into markets, Russia as it breaks into different markets, and all the rest. So there's the economic impact. There's the wider political impact, because we're going through Brexit negotiations and everything else. And, you know, everyone is looking at the Brexit negotiations for the potential harm that if we don't get a deal, that there will be on the UK. But people haven't recognised, because it's not being reported, the potential harm that will have on the other European nations as well, whenever one of their largest donors of the club has pulled out, and there's no plan for that money coming back into it again, and the political implications that that's going to have, very severe political implications that that's going to have across Europe. So there's a real interest in nation states trying to stir that up.
And that also has potential benefits to those nation states in creating that instability within Europe, because Europe in has for a long time been the biggest single community economy as a bloc that is able to compete with some of those other nations.
Yep. Yeah, no, very much so. And again, if you look at the propensity of the United States to go into America first, from a principal perspective, and there are now, you know, President Trump pushing Chinese business out as much as possible. They have to look at other markets, and they have a national strategy, both China and Russia, that, you know, we tend to separate out our military activity, our foreign office activity from a lot of our political activity, and keep clear blue water between the two of them. They don't. It's very fluid. And they will use military and civil capabilities across the board to try and influence trade as much as they will do from a security perspective. And we don't recognize that. We don't recognize that enough at all. And Xi Jinping, we're not seeing him coming out and making huge statements. We're not seeing lots of him reporting different things. But his influence is increasing across not just China, but the increase of China through Africa is phenomenal. The increase of China into other areas of Southeast Asia, in particular the Paracel and Spratly Islands in the South China Seas, is phenomenal. The growth of Chinese power projection capability from a military perspective is phenomenal. And the increase in cooperation between Russia and China, and traditionally they never quite got on that well together, is improving. I'll not say it's phenomenal. But then you bring in their influence into other nation state actors, and they have an influence on what's going on from a wider security perspective. And I'll bring in North Korea here in particular. Not many people know that there are only two internet pipes into North Korea. One that's been there for years and years and years is provided by China, because China is North Korea's only ally, and it keeps the trade going with it. And it's a relatively small pipe. But about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, there was a very large internet pipe put in. And that was put in by the Russian National Railway Company, completely run out of the Kremlin. And you have to ask, why did they put a huge internet pipe into North Korea?
Now, okay, I will. Phil, why did they put a huge internet pipe into North Korea?
Well, it's because North Korea is a plausibly deniable outlet for cyber attacks around the world. How can a country which has got no connections with academia out in the outside world become a leading cyber actor? It doesn't have access to the modern technology. So how can it get the modern technology? All of a sudden, at the time, just before this pipe was put in, it was going with this strategic missile system. It was failing 8 times out of 10 with short-range missiles, and it went within a less than 12-month period to being successful 9 times out of 10 for long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles as it tested it. There's a lot going on in the background that we don't quite know about and hasn't been exposed. And therefore, I'm speculating here, but from an informed perspective, that the influence from both Russia and China into someone that they can easily use as a plausibly deniable outlet for what they're doing around the place, both political influence, look at Kim Jong-un meeting President Trump and everything there was around there. That's a distraction activity that can be turned on and turned off at will, through to North Korea being blamed for some of the bigger cyber attacks that are around the place. Where did they learn how to do it?
So we've got Uncle Russia trading technology, capability, knowledge, etc. with North Korea. And in return, North Korea agrees to be Uncle Russia's patsy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And we see the same in many cases with Iran. Iran's a slightly different matter, and that's got a greater influence across the Middle East. But, you know, he who controls or has influence over the politics in Iran has an influence over what is, you know, the Middle East boils down to effectively it's a civil war between Sunni and Shia Muslims. The geographic boundaries are artificial things that were put in place by civil servants in Paris and in London at not the turn of the last century, the turn of the century beforehand, when they drew straight lines on maps and invented names of countries which didn't exist beforehand. So it's the old Sunni Shia civil conflict that's going on. That's being fought out as proxy wars between US-supported Saudi Arabia and Iran, supported by other political players in the world.
Tactfully put. But of course, you know, it's very easy for people like us to sit here and say, okay, it's this nation state, it's that nation state, these are the global politics, and that's all very interesting. But actually, what we often miss, and what I think there isn't enough reporting on, is that in all of these countries, and in our own country right now, all of this, these global positioning, the cyber attacks that are state-sponsored, the misinformation, the filling of social media with absolute fake news, all of it actually, and I would come back again to what we started off talking about with Salisbury, is having a massive impact on real people in their real lives and putting real people's health at risk.
Yeah, it is. And I did a blog on this, which is on my website, called Hacking Your Serotonin. Now, the serotonin, as you know well, Mike, is your feel-good chemical in the brain that makes you look good. And the original hackers of your serotonin are marketing agencies. You know, hands that do dishes. We all remember yeah. that, and the music that goes on in the background of it, it makes you feel good. You see a nice smile, and you want to go and buy Fairy Liquid because it's going to save you money and do more dishes. The music, and I'm showing my age now, when tobacco advertising was allowed in the television, but the music yeah. that was behind the Hamlet advert as it strummed was designed to give you that feel-good factor and make you feel relaxed. It's influencing the feelings that you have as an individual. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that's influencing your serotonin levels and suggesting to you to go and buy this product. Now, taking that to the next level, and we saw this with the exploitation of the data that had come out from the Cambridge Analytica scandal and what they got from Facebook. And it's been shown scientifically in a number of different studies. And again, this is all in my blog, where if you examine people's postings on social media and elsewhere, you can identify what their motivators are. And some of those are overt motivators, and some of those are motivators under the table that you don't even realize yourself that are motivating. But in the same way that Facebook can target advertising at you by looking at your profile and looking at your interactions and send you goods and products that they know that you like, they're using artificial intelligence to do that. They can send you messaging and links to other groups to potentially join that is going to give messaging that they think that you will like and fit in with the narrative that they believe that you've got. And a lot of this profiling, I've seen a lot of it, they can identify people's political persuasions, what their priorities are within local communities, from a perspective of wanting the politicians to put things right, what the priorities are from a business perspective, what the priorities are from a personal perspective. And surprise, surprise, when that messaging starts coming in, people go, yeah, that's good. I believe that. Oh, that fits with what I want. And as human beings, we've got this desire to agree with stuff that fits with our own thoughts and our own beliefs. And when it's fed to you from legitimate sources, and from people that you have respect with because they're known celebrities or known commentators or anything else, you tend to believe it even more, and it reinforces it. If that messaging has been deliberately put together and paid for to be output by a political system that is trying to manipulate the way you're thinking rather than inform and let you find stuff that would be naturally out there, then that's manipulating your serotonin to think in a way from a political or other perspective that you might not necessarily have done, but you don't realize that you're being influenced that way. That is what the Russians are doing, and that is what the Chinese are doing today.
So, say interacting with fake profiles, I think that might be something that, certainly from our listeners' perspective, we could just expand on a little bit. I mean, I'm putting in mind that one of the first experiments in artificial intelligence that I remember seeing was Microsoft's foray into the world of AI Twitter with their Tay account. And we all saw, of course, what happened with that. So, obviously, things have moved on a huge amount in terms of the world of machine learning and artificial intelligence since then. So, you know, fake profiles used in what way for what end, Phil?
Fake profiles is an interesting one. There are fake profiles that have been set up that organized criminals are one set, but nation states are the other set. They set them up and generate an awful lot of followers by creating enough of a messaging going around to build up a complete followers list. And they then sell them on. They sell them on so that they've got all those followers to be able to put out these political messaging to very large numbers of people. And they use that. It's, a lot of the fake profiles are used for two reasons. The first one is plausible deniability. What? Me? Vladimir? I didn't set this up. This was nothing to do with me or any of my associates. That's an easy one when you've got a fake profile, because it's very difficult to attribute exactly where something has come from in cyberspace, and it's very easy to hide. And the second influence that there is with the use of the fake profiles is saturation. If you've got 100 fake profiles pushing messaging out to 100 people, rather than one genuine person pushing it out, you're getting this overload of information that's coming through. And if each of the profiles is reinforcing what each of the other profiles is doing, then your target individual or target individuals are more likely to believe what's going on because they think they're seeing information from different sources.
Right. We've seen elements of this, haven't we, during the coronavirus pandemic, in that there's been a huge amount of messages put out through social media, which are these copy and pastes, which is deliberately designed not to look like a forwarded message, but to look like a personal message.
Yeah.
And inevitably starts with the language of, I got this directly from a friend whose brother works in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just far enough to be non-attributable, but close enough for it to be believable.
And interestingly, from an intelligence background, we have a term for that. It's false collateral. So whenever we're running a human agent, human beings, and it depends on the motivation of the individual out there, ideally that human being is only going to talk to you, talk to your agency, talk to your organization, and not talk to anyone else. But the reality is, especially in operational theatres and all the rest of it, if that human individual finds that it can talk to you and you make them feel good and look after them, all the rest of it, but he knows that if he goes off to X countries, other intelligence operatives, and they're going to give him a small briefcase of money to talk to them, he's going to go and do that. And he goes off to Y countries and goes and gets another little briefcase of money, and he gets that. So he's, you know, he's feeling good because he's talking to all of these, and he's giving the same message. So he thinks he's or she's passing information across, and this is great, and he's getting the or she's getting the reward out of it. But then when all the different agencies are swapping intelligence around, you keep your sources very close to your chest and never reveal them. But all of a sudden you've got you know, country X, country Y, and our primary country are swapping information. You've got three bits of information all saying exactly the same thing that come in. None of them will reveal where the source is. And you've got, oh, crikey, I've got three reports saying this, therefore this must be happening. Instead of it's, I've got the same report from one person that's been given to three different people. And it puts a completely different spin on how you can trust that information, and that is really difficult to deal with. And that's where the botnets, the fake accounts, and all the rest of it can be used to manipulate people in a much faster and a much greater way.
Yes, a lie told three times is still a lie.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I wonder, just as we come towards the end of this one, then Phil, always like to have a little bit of a look towards the future. And just in the last couple of days, I've been following with interest the new hashtag Stop Hate for Profit, and the fallout of that being the number of large advertisers who have pulled their advertising from Facebook. The latest yesterday being Ben and Jerry's, the ice cream manufacturer.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, you know, is there a growing move to hold some of these larger social media accounts? There's been a lot of talk about, you know, Twitter blocking Donald Trump's tweets because they are not factual or contain potential violence or hate speech.
Yep.
Whilst Facebook, of course, continues to be openly criticised for not doing enough on its platform.
Yep.
And Ben and Jerry's have basically said they're pulling their advertising revenue until Facebook fundamentally changes its approach to managing online hate and misinformation.
Yeah.
So I just wonder, is that the start of maybe a step change where some of these companies, bearing in mind that, you know, Facebook's revenue from advertising is what, something like $70 billion?
Yeah. Well, it's, I think we're more than the start at the moment. There are two pieces of legislation going through from a security perspective, going through as a priority in UK government at the moment. The first one is what's called euphemistically Martin's Law, and that's about mandating a set of security standards for public gatherings around the place. And that's on the back of the terrible attack in Manchester a few years ago. The second bit of legislation is effectively building on or rewriting or developing the Computer Misuse Act. And the Computer Misuse Act came in 1990. So in 1990, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and all of these things didn't exist, so it's not fit for purpose in the modern era. And what the government is doing is changing the legislation and bringing in additional legislation to build on top of it to empower or insist that the social media giants that are out there have got some responsibility for the content that they're putting on it. And why is it appropriate that they do it? If we took every police officer from every country in the world and took them off the streets and put them purely on trying to police what's going on social media, we wouldn't have enough resources to do it.
Do we maybe even need to change the language there? I mean, is there any such thing these days as a social media platform? Or is, as we were talking about there with fake accounts and botnets and everything, hasn't social media just become another way to harvest millions of people in order to then create opinion and propaganda?
Yep.
They're huge data warehouses, really, aren't they? The fact that they give you a social media platform to play with whilst in the background they're manipulating you and exploiting you, it's just a byproduct.
This is where you get nothing for free. So why have I got a free Facebook account? That's because Facebook are doing everything that they can to profile you. And in fact, before the Cambridge Analytica incident happened, what Facebook was also doing was carrying out another exercise to business profile every individual that they got on there, so that they could look at how they fit into that to try and set up a business equivalent of Facebook. And they were encouraging the use of video to be posted up by anyone and everyone. And if you put a business related piece of video up, it got promoted amazingly without having to pay anything out to wider business communities. But this was them trying to prove their lists that they had been putting together to see if they were exactly accurate. And it would give you huge amounts of exposure into the relevant business areas without you knowing it was going on, because Facebook trying to prove their data. So anything that is out there is scraping your data and is looking at your data. And therefore, it's more than social media. It is a wider information and informing network, and it doesn't form part of the Ofcom regulations at the moment that our broadcasters have to be part of. And that's why political manipulation can go on it, whereas there are very clear political rules about what can be broadcast and what can't be broadcast. And therefore, it's perfectly appropriate where you've got the likes of Facebook with a $70 billion profit to actually take some responsibility for the content that is being posted up on there, and not just what the physical content is, but the effect that content can have if it is manipulative. And that will force them to produce the tools. And a lot of these are going to be artificial intelligence tools, but with humans in the loop as well, because AI will not work properly without having a human as the ultimate decision maker. Humans in the loop as well to properly police the content that's on their platforms that they're making profit out of.
And of course, they are capable of doing this, as much as their rhetoric says they're not. And I'm just interested, I've got a statement here from the sports goods maker, Patagonia, who are another advertiser who have pulled their revenue from Facebook. And they haven't pulled their punches. And their press statement says that for too long, Facebook has failed to take sufficient steps to stop the spread of hateful lies and dangerous propaganda on its platform. And, you know, given everything we've talked about in the course of this this podcast, of course, that just goes to the heart of it, doesn't it?
100%. And that, you can't get it put any more succinctly than that. And it's not just Facebook.
Of course.
It's easy to pick on Facebook, but all of the social media platforms have, or broadcasting communications platforms have their levels of influence. And Facebook's the oldest. They all have to take responsibility. And this second bit of UK legislation is going to force them to take responsibility, which can only be a good thing for society.
And of course, with their procurement of certain technologies like Instagram, that just continues to grow their power.
Exactly. Yeah. And they are continuing to grow their influence, their power and everything else across the globe. They are outside any political boundaries, as we know, within from a geographical and a country perspective. They've got the ability to move their headquarters, their profit centres and all the rest of it to any country in the world to get appropriate tax breaks and everything else. It is completely appropriate that as a community, as a society, as a global society, we insist that they do not perpetrate anything that can do society harm and take some responsibility for that.
I agree. Well, I think we're getting towards the end of our time here, Phil. And I just thought, you know, we can't end a podcast on information, misinformation and propaganda without a positive story that has come out of this pandemic. Captain Tom, or should it now be Colonel Tom, and the amazing amount of money that he raised walking up and down his garden for the NHS charities, which, of course, was largely driven by publicity that he received from social media and mainstream news outlets, of course. You know, I know BBC Breakfast championed him quite a lot. But what a phenomenal story that was.
Oh, absolutely superb. Colonel Sir Tom.
Of course.
I think it's absolutely fantastic what he did You know, he motivated himself. He wanted to do raise £1,000 by doing a few laps in his back garden. And actually, it shows that whilst there's all this gloom and doom in society, that's a relatively small proportion of society. I'll bring a lot of our mainstream press, and I'll bring a lot of our politicians into that relatively small proportion of society. The majority of society wants to latch onto something that's good, something that gives us that feel-good factor. And Colonel Sir Tom did just that at exactly the right time. And look at the absolutely amazing amount of money that he raised. Absolutely. And, you know, I've got an old... we called him an uncle. We always from Northern Ireland, good family friends and all the rest, called them uncles. But he was in the Duke of Wellington's regiment and was youngest ever regimental sergeant major in the Duke of Wellington's regiment. And Colonel Sir Tom was Duke of Wellington's regiment. So there was a bit of a connection there.
Oh, lovely.
It was absolutely superb.
And of course, got a lovely call from another Sir Tom. Who he managed to usurp in the chart records. So,
well, exactly. So, you know, not only is he a record breaker for the amount of money that he's got, not only has he been promoted from captain to colonel overnight and given a knighthood overnight, he got a number one record, and absolutely superb. And he's, you know, he's given a real sense of hope, I think, to the nation, and a real sense of identity. And it's... The other good thing that he's brought out is he's highlighted you know, the impact that veterans can have. And mm-hmm. You know, you and I are not quite at his age, but it's not going to be too many years off before we get there. And we hope we can still have the same influence that he's had when we get there.
Absolutely. An influence for the better of society.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Phil, as always, it's been brilliant, fascinating, interesting, funny, and enjoyable for me to be spending time talking to you. And I hope for those of you listening to this, you've enjoyed it as well. I think for me, what will I take away as major memories from a positive perspective of this pandemic? Well, Colonel Tom, rainbows, the massive outpouring of applause for the NHS, and let's hope that that is translated into recognition in terms of their treatment, their salary, their benefits and everything else in the long term. But most of all, a realization that as a British society, you know what, whatever comes along, we have a certain amount of spirit and, shall I say, gumption in us that will allow us to continue to face whatever the future brings and to walk together into the light. Phil, thanks very much for your time today.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. I can't top what you said and agree completely. It's been a real pleasure.